And Father Richard Rice is also with us now. I'm not quite sure whether Mr. John Chrysostomidis, representing the family, is with us or not. So far as I can see, he's not with us. Now, dear fellow students, dear colleagues and dear friends, a warm welcome to you all from the students, the staff, the members, and the friends of the Hellenic Institute at Royal Holloway, University of London, the School of Humanities. Thank you for honoring us with your presence at our annual memorial for our teacher, the distinguished Byzantinist, Julian Chrysostomidis. For our Greek and Cypriot friends, Iuliani Chrysostomidou. Tomorrow is the 12th anniversary of her passing away on the 18th of October, 2008. 12 years have passed, and her physical absence is ever present at our institute, our college, and among her many students, colleagues, and friends. This year, we had originally planned to hold her memorial in the college chapel on our campus in England, Surrey, which is very beautiful, by the way, especially in the autumn. However, the governmental restrictions in order to control the continued pandemic in England prevented us from doing so, despite the kind offer from the chaplain of our college chapel, Father John Dixon, to use it for this purpose. Instead, Julian gathered us today in the digital universe. I was about to prepare a longer speech to introduce our speaker, Dr. Kostas Kalingdzis, but he insisted that this would not be appropriate, as the person honored today is not him, but Julian Chrysostomidis. So following his wise advice, I will be brief. Kostas Kalingdzis received his PhD in philosophy from the University of South Florida in the United States of America. He has served on the board of the International Association for Greek Philosophy and is an honorary research associate of the Hellenic Institute at Royal Holloway. Kostas has devoted his academic life to exploring ancient Greek thought and reflecting on how Greek philosophy can give solutions to questions, problems, and challenges we face in the modern world. He's the author of three books, the first on Aristotle on Political Enmity and Disease, an inquiry into stasis. The second book is titled Taming Anger, the Hellenic Approach to the Limitations of Reason. And more recently, his third book, an inquiry into the philosophical concept of scholi, leisure as a political end. And it is this theme that you will be discussing in this lecture. Kostas.
Before I begin, Haralambe, I wish to say just a few words of a personal nature about Julian, whom I first met in 2003. I was traveling to England that winter, and I arrived at Royal Holloway on a bitterly cold day. We introduced ourselves, and then Julian took me by the arm and said to me with her charming smile, "Kostas, this will not do. We have to get you into something warmer." She then took me to the school's bookstore and bought me a sweater as a gift. All this occurred quickly under her firm yet gentle hand. Thus, from the first moment, I came to know of her magnanimity, and I came to see that this was reflected in her speech, her gestures, her reactions, all of which exuded nobility, whose compass was the betterment of the persons she came into association with. I came to realize that the same loving care which she showed to me on that day, she showed daily, hourly, to all her students around the clock, and not just to those gifted young students who were to go on to become renowned scholars, but even to students over 80 years old who had come to learn the wonders of paleography in the last phase of their life. She will always live on in the memories of those who had the good fortune of meeting and knowing her. My presentation in memory of Julian is on leisure and education, παιδεία and σχολή. There are uncountable articles that have been written on the subject of leisure and the possibilities it offers for moral and intellectual improvement through education. This, however, is not my topic, for the Greek word σχολή, from which the words school, scholarship, scholar, scholastic are all derived, differs greatly in meaning and in nuances from anything connoted by leisure. Thus, it is necessary to first ascertain the nature of σχολή, then to identify the education that is appropriate as a means to this end, and finally, to explain the elevation of σχολή to the supreme purpose of the political association. The elucidation of these interwoven concepts was the accomplishment of Aristotle, and thus his theory of leisure is the focus of my presentation, though I will briefly turn to Plato's concept of σχολή so as to economically bring to the fore the difficulties involved when leisure is posited as a political end and projected onto the entire polis as the overarching aim of public life. A way to begin to grasp the differences between σχολή and what we mean by leisure is to note at the outset that σχολή was a prized value deeply embedded in Hellenic culture, and that the philosophical concepts of leisure were developed within this antecedent cultural framework rather than being the cause or the origin of it. I shall give but one brief example to show that this was the case. We shall recall the famous episode in the Odyssey in which Odysseus, wearied from his shipwreck, politely declines to partake in the athletic contest that his Phaeacian hosts have organized in his honor. At that point, a brash youth, Evrylaos, accuses Odysseus, whose identity has yet to be revealed, of being unfit for receiving the type of hospitality that the island reserves for noble persons, on the grounds that he's probably a merchant motivated by nothing but profit, which would make him incapable of partaking in the leisure activities of the Phaeacians. The merchant, he says, is only mindful of his cargo and is constantly preoccupied with how to make more money. Such a person, having a moral outlook primed solely to utility is not expected to be able to partake in the competitions or in the symposia or in the musical contests of the Phaeacians, no matter how much free time and money such a person would have at his disposal. From this episode, we can readily see that Scholí pointed not merely to free time, but to ways of life that made use of such time, and to the moral upbringing and education requisite to partaking in these life choices. With this background in mind, I shall turn to Plato, who was the first philosopher to systematically explore the nature of leisure. His central idea is that attendance to the body's needs results in busyness. The Greek word is ascholia, the opposite of scholí. And this is why we have so little time for inquiry into the true causes and into the nature of things. Leisure, in its defining sense, is a moral and intellectual condition in which one's free time is spent on gazing or theorizing into the true nature of things. This gazing presupposes a moral catharsis from the body's perturbations and from all standards of value that have the body's needs as a metric. Scholí, he argued, involves the power of nous, what is often translated as mind. For nous is that which understands the nature of things in their best possible condition. Thus it is that nous, in leisure, discovers theorizing to be the highest human activity, which occurs within the best possible moral condition. Paradoxically, it is in leisure that the nature of nous is discovered, and it is then through the activity of nous that we come to understand the purpose of scholí. Because leisure is a condition in which humans experience the best possible within themselves, one would expect that Plato would have given considerable thought to its realization as a political end for the polis. Yet this he rejects, and not as an afterthought, but as an impractical perspective. In the Laws, his final work, we learn that citizens are to enjoy ample free time. Half their time is to be spent in leisure, primarily in festive dance and choral singing, which are to be politically crafted by philosopher legislators as imitations of the divine order. Serious play is meant to instill within the emotional marrow of every citizen pleasure and pain preferences that will allow them to conduct their lives according to the laws for their common welfare. Philosophy is presented as the highest form of divine imitation and the most exalted type of serious play, but it is reserved for only a tiny handful of extraordinary people. In short, theoria, as a polis-wide objective to be pursued in leisure, as a shared reality for all of humanity, is never entertained. Plato, why this is so, we can only speculate, but I suspect this was because Plato believed, as he says in the Timaeus, that humans, quote, share little in the truth, and that we must declare that of right opinion, all humankind shares in it, but nous is a property of the gods and of very few men, end quote. What astounds to this day is that Aristotle boldly asserted what his teacher had come to reject. He redefines folie proper as the condition within which human nature is actualized, and he declared it to be, for empirical as well as theoretical reasons, essential to both human flourishing and to the polis's survival. On empirical grounds, he argued that the demise of powerful cities, such as Sparta, tends to occur in times of victory and prosperity, and not in times of war and duress. Quote, "The cause is that the lawmaker did not educate them to be capable in the use of their leisure," end quote. And from theoretical insight into the nature of human completeness, he made the original claim that, quote, "leisure seems itself to contain pleasure and happiness and felicity of life." Furthermore, he holds folie to be an end embedded in the very biology of the human species. Quote, "Nature itself seeks to be able not only to engage rightly in business, but also to be in leisure nobly." Elsewhere, he states, "Every human being has been created by God for the purpose of knowing and theorizing," end quote. Aristotle's classification of leisure as end provided a way to evaluate types of free time activities. Thus, the popular view of the lower Athenian classes who had come to believe that they were engaging in leisure when they obtained subsidies, which permitted them to take an active part in the governing of their city, could be dismissed, because ruling and power, these are not ends, they are means to a good life. Likewise, all forms of relaxation and play were not to be conflated with leisure. Leisure begins only after the harsh demands for existence are satisfied, and these survival needs call for strenuous effort as well as anapafsis, literally a pause, so that one may start again over. He thus showed that for adults, play belonged not to leisure as such, but to the replenishment phase of work. Nor was learning to be thought of as scholie in its defining sense. With respect to intellectual cultivation, Aristotle occasionally uses the word diagogi, which literally means that something is being conducted or transported by someone or something. Thus, Hermes, who transports souls in the underworld across the river Styx, is called diagoyevs. Learning may be said to be a necessary transitional phase, which transports us to the opposite bank, where nous will be in operation. But leisure itself is not preparation, but something possessed in which activity is ready to function. Learning and its travails and its joys are definitely the gateways to scholie, and would no doubt comprise most of the free time activities of such a culture. But even so, it has to be distinguished from the end, just as learning to play the violin is distinguished from performing a violin concerto. Though theoria may be said to be the highest and noblest human activity, one is truly left perplexed as to how this ideal might ever be practical. Many have held that Aristotle was either confused or contradicted himself or lost when he made this claim. Yet, it is the very clarity of his political proposal that baffles us to this day. The development of the moral virtues, which in Plato form the content of leisure activities, are deemed by Aristotle to be only means. He calls them stewards to true happiness. Theoretical activity and leisure as end, precisely that which his teacher thought was impossible or unrealizable, Aristotle proclaims to be the practical aim of politics. But is it not absurd to believe that the distinguishing activity of leisure, theoria, could ever become desirable as an end for an entire society? Here, we can note that the Athenian democracy, in which tragedy functioned as an indispensable component of their leisure, did not require that all citizens be able to write tragedy as Aeschylus or Euripides or Sophocles in order to participate in it. Many of us today swim and jog and belong to a myriad of amateur groups at all levels without any hope of ever making it to the Olympics. Yet we still participate in these activities whose standards are set by champion athletes. For that matter, it may be said that even capitalism doesn't require that we all become billionaires in order to partake in it. Though not everyone embodies theoretical wisdom, all citizens would be sufficiently cultured within their practices and habits of association to recognize and to show respect for nous's presence. They would be encouraged through the polis's standard for reverence and honor to imitate the role models that the just persons provide and to assimilate those models into their practices. Even if all do not possess nous fully, they could all recognize it and uphold its values. But one might question the validity of our analogy. One could say that theater and sports can easily be embraced by any multitude, but the toils of theoria have always been the reserve of a few. How can nous ever be cherished socially if only a handful ever experience it? Here, one might perhaps argue that Aristotle had a special curriculum in mind that would train youth intellectually and emotionally so that when they grew up, they would become desirous of engaging in theoria. However, in his Politics, in Book 8, where he inquires into the education, the paedia, that would be appropriate to the best constitution, there is no such proposal to be found. Instead, when he delves into the curriculum that would best suited for happiness as end, he argues that it has to be the one that prepares citizens for engaging in leisure. And in this context, rather than speaking of theoria, he speaks only of music. This is startling. He states, "That is why our ancestors introduced music into education, not as something necessary, because there is nothing necessary about it, nor because it was useful. It remains, therefore, that it was clearly with respect to pastime in leisure towards which they directed it, and it is because they believed that it contributed to the way of life of free persons." The ancients, he points out, included music in the curriculum because they thought it contributed to the pastimes that were appropriate to the life of free persons. The word he uses for pastime here is diagogi, but here it means a way of life, which is to say that the pastimes have been ordered in a purposeful way, in this case, to support a way of life appropriate to free persons, a way that will allow them to go across to Skoli. He repeats this several times, quote, "It is clear, therefore, that there is a form of education in which youth should be trained, not because it is useful or necessary, but because it is noble and liberal and befitting a free person," end quote. To grasp the full significance of Aristotle's comments on the role of music in the city's educational program, I shall compare what he states above to Plato's musical curriculum as put forth in the Laws. Both put forth curricula and training programs that have friendship between the citizens in mind, based on shared values and purposes. But when we examine their proposals closely, a sharp difference emerges. Plato argues that friendship, which would result from common activity in play, especially in the city's music program, is to be formulated and regulated by wise legislators for the good of the citizen body. One could almost say that the character traits of free persons are to be produced in an unfree way. The citizens who are to be brought up to live self-directed lives are not truly in command of the emotional habits that are being formed for the most self-conscious of all ends. In Aristotle's view, what puts citizens in touch with the highest capacity within them is not the singing or dancing per se that they partake in, but the music which they themselves as citizens have selected and which they regulate, control, and direct to a specific end. No music created and recommended to passive receptors for their good will ever be appropriate for free persons. In Aristotle's view, the mark of free persons is that their way of life, their diagogi, is not the result of habits that have been configured for them, but rather the selection of how the habits are to be formed with the best in mind is their way of life. The cultivation of free persons by way of liberal education does not entail that we dispense with productive craft activity, for that would be absurd. Rather, it asserts that all practical strivings be for the sake of actualizing the highest capacities of our humanity. That this should be a candidate course for the direction of education is not based on the utopian dream. Throughout history, humans have bestowed the highest honors to those men and women, to Pythagoras, to Hypatia, to Einstein, whose findings were born of useless wonder. This is counterintuitive, because knowledge which solves pressing practical problems is so connected with basic human needs for survival, and thus one would have expected utility to be a more likely candidate for the greatest honors. this impulse to search for the causes must therefore arise from a psychological source that is more deeply human than the capacities that attend to utility, and hence is more indicative of who we are as a species. The fact that only few strive to overcome their ignorance is often cited as evidence that the impulse to inquire is limited to a handful of theoretically minded persons. But this is not so. Aristotle, in the opening sentence of his Metaphysics, writes, quote, "All human beings by nature have appetite to know, both the pleasurable arousal to know and the pain of ignorance are, like the desire to eat, appetitively driven and hence shared by all." These hedonics are powerfully threaded into the human species, but they fully emerge as inquiry only in leisure. That is why the impulse to understand is naturally aroused in a university setting, for here the reduction of everything to objects of utility is overcome, because the freedom to wonder, thavmazin in Greek, to wonder and to inquire as an end in itself, is or should be the norm. Even so, one may on good grounds argue that even if the motivation to partake in inquiry is stimulated in the university setting, this does not support Aristotle's broader claim that life of scholae would be desirable for the rest of humankind. Indeed, there is no evidence even in Aristotle that participation in theoretical life will come from a curriculum directed to the cultivation of theoretical research. Nowhere do we find a discussion in the Politics along the lines that we find in the Republic, where Socrates lays out a curriculum in abstract mathematics and astronomy that will lead one to theoretical contemplation. Aristotle instead seems to have believed that if nous is the highest human faculty, and as such is that which determines human identity, then if one were truly free, one would not fail to select it as the criterion for choices that have bearing on the greatest matters of one's life. To be free is to live one's own life, and the only thing that is truly our own is our theoretical faculty, for it is this faculty that uniquely identifies us as a species. It is because of it that we can seek out the causes and derive sound principles to formulate purposes that give meaningful direction for living our lives in the best possible way. Quote, "For it would be absurd if one were not to choose to live one's own life, but someone else's," end quote. We can thus see why it would be a mistake to think that the practicality of scholae as a way of life will be determined or might be determined by economic contingencies. John Maynard Keynes, for example, in an essay published in 1930 entitled "Economic Possibilities for Our Grandchildren," concluded that advances in productivity would make leisure the central problem of life by the year 2030. Yet, the great increases in productivity that have occurred since then have not produced freer citizens, but have created overworked, frightened, insecure, and indebted workers. But even if perchance leisure were to be mandated by those ruling over society, it would most likely be used, as was in the case of Rome, where the 180 days of free time was available for promoting debauchery in the population. For us, that would mean free time to partake in a brave new world. Sfolie, as a way of life, never was, nor will it ever be determined by the invisible hand of economics or technological progress, but from political and moral choices. If this indeed is the case, then it must follow that developments in the classrooms, and not those unfolding in demonstrations in the streets, will be decisive for the future of humanity. For it is the kindergartens and the lecture halls where the different ways of life will be decided. If citizens were to realize the utmost importance of this issue, they would not, I believe, leave this matter up to academics or to politicians, and certainly not up to corporations who advocate in a militant way education aimed at creating consumers and slaves to technology. Parenthetically, would not this molding of education for Sfolie require that philosophy be cultivated throughout society? Because given that it is the only branch of knowledge that considers the good as a whole, and thus without it, would citizens be able to formulate correct judgments about the use of goods available to them for their treasured way of life, for their happiness? We must therefore ask ourselves whether our present curricula will be for a way of life that reduces mind to a clever Sisyphean instrument in the service of ever more destructive gratifications, or whether we shall have the boldness to shape it in political friendship for character traits befitting the happiness of free persons. Thank you.
Thank you, Costa. It gives me great pleasure to invite the Reverend Professor Emeritus Andrew Lauf to give the vote of thanks to our speaker on behalf of all of us. Father Andrew, if you would be so kind to unmute also your microphone.
Well, it is a great privilege to be asked to do this. This is both a lecture in honor of Julian herself and also a wonderful survey of the relationship between Scholi and Pythia. And these are concerns that are not just concerns of classically minded scholars, they're concerns that are very close to us today. It's one thing that was in the back of my mind as I listened to Costas is that the very language that we use nowadays turns everything on its head. We talk about business and leisure, and there's no real connection between them. Whereas to take those two terms in Latin or in Greek are the other way around. Leisure is the unnegated term. Business is what we do when we are not at leisure, when we are not engaged in scholarly. And that reversal of value seems to me to be a fundamental challenge to anybody attempting to preserve some of the values of what we still call the academy in the world in which we live nowadays. And I don't think I need to remind any of you that in Britain at least, but I'm sure actually throughout the whole of the Western world, the values of the academy are not appreciated very widely. And so Costas's careful and thoughtful consideration of the way in which these ideas were thought of in the ancient world have very direct relevance to our attempts to understand what it is that we want to what we want universities to be in the world in which we live. And so I think I can speak for all of us in thanking Costas very much for the fine and brief lecture that he's given us. I don't know how we do the applause on Zoom, but let us, as it were, do this all together, at least with our minds, if not anything else. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Father. And I would like to thank you on behalf of the Hellenic Institute, all those who were present for honoring us with your presence. Costa, thank you very much for an exceptional lecture on this 12th anniversary of Julian Chrysostomidis' passing away. Her spirit and vision lives on and guides us. May I kindly ask Father Andrew to say a little prayer for Julian's soul so that we close this event in her honor and in her memory.
Let us pray to the Lord. O God of spirits and all flesh, who trample down death and crush the devil, giving life to your world, do you, Lord, give rest to the soul of your servant Julia, who has fallen asleep, in a place of light, a place of green pasture, a place of refreshment, from where pain, grief, and sighing have fled away. Pardon, O God, as you are good and love mankind, every sin committed by her in word or deed or thought, because there is none who will live and not sin. For you alone are without sin, your righteousness is an everlasting righteousness, and your word is truth. For you are the resurrection of the life and the repose of your servant Julia, who has fallen asleep, Christ our God. And to you we give glory, together with your Father who is at the beginning, and your all-holy good and life-giving Spirit, now and forever, and to the ages of ages.
Thank you very much. And we will meet again in a year's time. God bless you.